Good to see everybody back this evening. Hope you've had a pleasant day. I was thinking of that, Mark talking about we don't have a lot of lighthouses around here. I think it was in Sunray I was speaking, and it was a series of speakers there, and they had a setup for PowerPoint presentations for all the speakers except for me, because I'm just that far backwards and always have been, and I know how to do a PowerPoint presentation. I'm just not overly enamored with the taking of the time to do so. And so instead of putting up a PowerPoint presentation for me, they showed a picture of a lighthouse. And so I just thanked them for having a picture of Happy Texas to make me feel at home. And they kind of understood. But speaking of feeling at home, I know that Keith and Lori's family are just really enjoying being here from their vacation from Hawaii, getting away from that place, and being able to come to the panhandle of Texas in the summer and enjoy all that we have to offer. And so it's great to have them here. We've got several others that are visiting as well. And it's just really nice to have each one of you, as well as those of you who are faithful to be here every time. We have been this last, I guess, 2 months looking at a new Bible reading challenge. We first of all looked at the books of Moses, and then we went into the champions, or the judges and the kings, and looked at them. And so we're just starting to get into Ezra and Nehemiah, and today's readings are from Job. Read Esther yesterday, if you're keeping up with it. But I wanted to kind of go back now and look at some of the things that we have been involved with the past couple of months, and just ask you what these things have in common. I have to remember to stop 2 minutes early because I set my watch 2 minutes late. Y'all can keep me honest on that. But think about this. What do these things have in common? Cain's killing of Abel, Esau's selling of his birthright, Israel's refusal to go into Canaan, Saul's offering of the sacrifice at Gilgal, David's adultery with Bathsheba and the killing of Uriah, and Shimei's cursing of King David. Six separate things, half a dozen different things. Cain, Esau, the Israelites at Canaan, Saul with the offering, David's adultery and murder, and then Shimei. At first, we might think that there isn't anything in common other than maybe the fact that they all involve sin. But even that may not be correct, because there's not necessarily a sin involved with Esau selling his birthright. It was certainly a poor decision, and there could have been something within his heart or within his attitude that was sinful that we're not told about. But just in and of itself, Esau's selling of his birthright just wasn't the brightest thing to do, especially under the circumstances that he did it. But the rest of them, Cain's murder of his brother, the Israelites' refusing to go into Canaan when they were commanded to, Saul making an offering in the place of the priests, and then of course David with his adultery and murder, and then Shimei, as David was being driven out of Jerusalem, cursing David, the Lord's anointed. Those all did involve sin. But really, when you look at it, the one thing that we can say all these things have in common is that they resulted from a lack of self-control. Self-control certainly is, the lack thereof is certainly sin, although there are certain things I'm not really sure that you would want to apply a sinful label to everything that's a lack of self-control. Having an extra potato chip or something like that, I'm not really sure that God is that fine on what he considers sin. But these other things are very clear. As a matter of fact, when you think about it, God's commandments are clear on the things that are important. The plan of salvation, the way that we worship, the things that are right, the things that are wrong, they're very clear. The only thing that makes them clouded either is our lack of study and our lack of being aware of these things, or our refusal to go along with them. But I want to look at particularly two of these tonight. The first, Cain and Abel. But as we start looking at that, it'll start in Genesis chapter 4, if you want to be turning over there. Let me just read this passage in Proverbs. It's found in 25:28, and it says, "Like a city whose walls are broken down is a man who lacks self-control." You think about the time that this was written. Certainly, a city wall was there for protection. It wasn't just to delineate the fact that this was the city, but an important part of any city of any importance was to have a wall that would offer them a place to defend the city from. And so God has Solomon write that like a city whose walls are broken down is a man who lacks self-control. When we lack self-control, we've lost our defense, or a very important part of our defense. And so, keeping that in mind, let's start with Cain. In Genesis chapter 4 and verse 2, the latter half, it says, Abel kept flocks, and Cain worked the soil. In the course of time, Cain brought some of the fruits of the soil as an offering to the Lord, but Abel brought fat portions from some of the firstborn of his flock. The Lord looked with favor on Abel and his offerings, but on Cain and his offering he did not look with favor. So Cain was very angry, and his face was downcast. Now, we might think this isn't fair at first, since Cain was a farmer and Abel raised sheep at the very least. But when we look at Hebrews, we see that Abel was able to offer a sacrifice by faith. We know that faith comes by hearing. And so we know that there was some instruction. Otherwise, it wouldn't have been very fair. Now, again, I suppose their attitudes could have entered into this and other things that we're not privy to, but we do know that God looked with favor on Abel's sacrifice and not on Cain's, and Cain knew it. And so in verse 5, when after it said on Cain and his offering he did not look with favor, it says, so Cain was very angry and his face was downcast. And the Lord said to Cain, why are you angry? Why is your face downcast? If you do what is right, will you not be accepted? I think if we could kind of keep this particular principle in mind, it's one of the first eternal principles that we have within Scripture, or one of the early, maybe I should put it that way. We would do very well. If we do what is right, we're going to be accepted. And that's the question, the rhetorical question that the Lord gives to Cain. But it doesn't seem to phase Cain at all. God goes on to say, if you do not do what is right, sin is crouching at your door. It desires to have you, but you must master it. And so now we're going to see something that's a very critical part of self-control, and that is self-discipline. We have to master certain things. We might think that we are just who we are and that we can't help who we are. We look at different personalities, and fortunately we all do have different personalities. But along with those personalities, in addition to the strengths that they sometimes have, we also have weaknesses. There are certain personalities, mine is one of them, that goes more towards anger and impatience than it would to depression and inactivity. I usually rush in and do the wrong thing, but I very rarely am still when I'm doing it. And very often I'm not controlling my anger. This is one of the things you have to do. You cannot just tell people, well, that's just the way I am. I have a bad temper, as if that excuses you any more than you can tell people, well, that's just who I am. I'm a liar. I'm an adulterer. I'm a murderer. You cannot claim that somehow sin is associated with the way that God has made you, because certainly it hasn't. But this idea of sin desiring to have Cain, but that Cain had the responsibility of mastering it, shows us that he had to control himself. He was mad. Why was he mad? Well, Cain was receiving favor and he wasn't. How come? Abel was receiving favor and he wasn't. And the reason, of course, is because Abel, by faith, was doing what God wanted, and Cain, apparently in disobedience, was not. And because of that, Cain was in disfavor with God, but instead of correcting that, instead of catching himself and repenting of what he had done, he decided to carry it a step further, ignoring God's warning. In verse 8, Cain said to his brother Abel, let's go out to the field. And while they were in the field, Cain attacked his brother Abel and killed him. This is one of the things that hopefully from the very earliest times we can see what a lack of self-control will do. Do you see how quickly a lack of self-control with his temper and with his patience led to him actually killing somebody, killing his own brother? Just a heinous crime. And so God confronts him with this, and we remember the part of him asking if he's his brother's keeper. God didn't accept that. In verse 11, he said, "You're under a curse, driven from the ground, which opens its mouth to receive your brother's blood from your hand. When you work the ground, it will no longer yield its crops for you. You'll be a restless wanderer on the earth." Cain said to the Lord, "My punishment is more than I can bear." And so this is, I believe, one of the greatest lessons we need to learn. When we have a lack of self-control that goes unchecked, the punishment for that is very often something that we're not able to deal with. Cain said, "It's more than I can bear." Well, we know that God doesn't give us anything more than we can deal with as long as we are approaching it from a standpoint of righteousness. But Cain still is having a difficulty with that idea of righteousness. There's a couple of Proverbs that I believe really apply to this. Proverbs 29 and 11 says, "A fool gives full vent to his anger, but a wise man keeps himself under control." Have you ever been around anybody giving full vent? Again, I want to say a lot of times people just kind of give themselves a pass for this. But this says this: the one that gives full vent to his anger is a fool. A fool is somebody who is morally deficient. A fool is somebody from a spiritual standpoint that is either lost or in danger of being lost. This is one of the reasons I believe Jesus said that we could not call our brother a fool because by calling him that, we're making a judgment that we're not permitted to make upon them. And so we need to understand that a fool gives full vent to his anger and examine ourselves and see if we fall under that category. A wise man keeps himself under control. And then Proverbs 19:19 says a hot-tempered man must pay the penalty. I always thought if I could add one of the Proverbs to the book of Proverbs, it would be "a fool and his lips are soon split," because I cannot tell you how many times I have paid the penalty for my hot temper. Somebody made me mad, I responded, they responded. We all know how things can escalate. There are times we just go back and we lick our wounds and we think about, I really don't have anybody to blame but myself. It's our lack of self-control. One of the reasons we teach our children discipline, one of the reasons that we have to exercise discipline in our own lives, is that if we don't discipline ourselves, other people will. I look at our society right now. I look at the idea that somehow it is cruel to punish your children in such a way that inflicts pain upon them. I don't know exactly what the thought behind this is. We've bought into Satan's lie that somehow punishment should not be unpleasant. It's ridiculous. If we don't discipline our children, society eventually will. If we don't discipline ourselves, society eventually will have to discipline us. The reason we have prisons is because people do not exercise self-control and they have no discipline. Well, the other instance that I want to look at is David. We're very familiar with this particular passage, but I want to start in 2 Samuel chapter 11 and verse 2. And again, notice how quickly a lack of self-control escalates to the point where if somebody told us we would do something like this, I doubt if we would believe it. I have an idea that if somebody had come to David before this had happened, especially when you think of who David was and how he loved the law of God, he probably would scoff at this idea. But look at the series of events. Starting in verse 2 of 2 Samuel 11, "One evening David got up from his bed and walked around the roof of the palace. From the roof he saw a woman bathing. The woman was very beautiful, and David sent someone to find out about her." Well, there's a lot of things here that we don't know. We don't know if this was the only place that she could bathe, and we don't know if David was a peeping Tom. We don't know if she was intentionally trying to be seen by David or somebody else. We don't know any of the circumstances that lead up to this. What we do know is that once David observed this woman bathing, he should have had the discipline and the self-control to look away. But instead, he didn't. He wanted to find out about her. Well, as king of Israel, and during this time, certainly they had the right to take more than one wife. And so David sends inquiries about her. And the man that got the inquiry says, the man said, "Isn't this Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam and the wife of Uriah the Hittite?" Now, whether anything completely untoward had happened yet or not, at this point, there has to be a decision made by David. David now knows that this is a married woman, and not just married to anybody. This is Uriah the Hittite. Uriah the Hittite was one of David's mighty men. Since David is about to do away with him, we understand that his heroism must have occurred before this point for him to be listed as one of David's mighty men. He was someone loyal to David. He was a hero of Israel. And now David finds that this woman that he's interested in is married to Uriah. Well, it didn't matter. David sent messengers to get her. She came to him. He slept with her. She had purified herself from her uncleanness. Then she went back home. The woman conceived and sent word to David, "I am pregnant." You ever gotten yourself in trouble? You didn't really realize. Maybe you thought you got away with something, but then word comes back to confirm that you didn't get away with it at all. And now David's got a decision to make. And it's a big decision because his sin was big. As a matter of fact, had he not been king, this was a capital offense. He and Bathsheba both would have been stoned. I don't know that the kings were exempt from this. It may have very well been that David should have been stoned at this point, certainly with Bathsheba. But instead of that, he decides to deceive, to try and get out of it. So he tries to make Uriah think that this child is his own. And when he finds out that he can't do that, he decides to have Uriah killed. And the way that he does it, as we watch this escalation from a lack of self-control, he didn't avert his eyes. He didn't allow another man's wife to remain another man's wife. He now goes to the point of not only killing Uriah, but he does so with a plan that is sure to kill other people. And other soldiers were surely killed in this. And not only that, he involved Joab, the commander of his army. Wasn't just the commander of David's army. This was the commander of the Lord's army, because Israel was the nation that belonged to the Lord. And yet David, in his madness or his intent to conceal what he had done, came up with a plan that would kill Uriah. And sure enough, it did. There were several people killed in this instance, apparently. And David, again, probably thought he got away with it. David brought Bathsheba in after a period of time to be his wife. Now, 2 Samuel chapter 12 and verse 1. The Lord sent Nathan to David. He came to him and he said, and he gives him a story. I like this story because it's an animal story, and an animal story always tugs at the heartstrings, does it not? There were two men in a certain town, one rich, the other poor. The rich man had a very large number of sheep and cattle, but the poor man had nothing except one little ewe lamb which he had bought. He raised it, and it grew up with him and his children. It shared his food, drank from his cup, even slept in his arms. It was like a daughter to him. Now a traveler came to the rich man, but the rich man refrained from taking one of his own sheep or cattle to prepare a meal for the traveler who had come to him. Instead, he took the ewe lamb that belonged to the poor man and prepared it for the one who had come to him. Well, David hears this story, and it says he burned with anger against the man. He said to Nathan, "As surely as the Lord lives, the man who did this deserves to die." Now, this is not a capital offense, is it? But David looks at this type of a callous heart, and he says, that guy deserves to die. But he's not going to give him the death penalty. He says he must pay for that lamb four times over because he did such a thing and had no pity. Now, lest you think that this is just a random thought that comes from David, in Exodus chapter 22 and verse 1, we are told that part of the law that was given to Moses was if a man steals another man's lamb, that he has to pay back four times. David was so familiar with the law of God that he not only knew this was wrong, but he knew what the penalty was for it to the very lamb. And yet somewhere in his convoluted thinking, he was resting easy with what he had done in this small matter of lust, adultery, murder. Nathan said to David, "You are the man." I don't know about you, but there's been a time or two in my life where somebody has come to me with information that just made my heart sink. Something that I had done, either that I didn't know that I had done, or something that I did know that I had done that I got caught on. But you can only imagine David when Nathan says, "You're the man." This is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. "I anointed you king of Israel. I delivered you from the hand of Saul. I gave your master's house to you, your master's wives into your arms." I don't think he's talking about those who had actually been married to Saul. I imagine he's just talking about the ones who are available to the king for a wife after that point. But I don't know. We're not really privy to that information. "I gave you the house of Israel and Judah. And if all this had been too little, I would have given you even more. Why did you despise the word of the Lord by doing evil in his eyes? You struck down your Uriah the Hittite with the sword and took his wife to be your own. You killed him with the sword of the Ammonites. Therefore the sword will never depart from your house because you despised me and took the wife of Uriah the Hittite to be your own." And he goes on to reveal the penalty that is going to happen, that's going to fall upon his house and upon those he loves. Well, David did repent of his sin. He confessed his sin. He repented of it. Nathan told him that God had forgiven him of his sin, but he didn't remove the physical penalty. Spiritual penalty is now gone. And that's something that, of course, is of the utmost importance and hopefully will be of the utmost interest to us as we look at this. But again, just think about these things. We looked at what Cain did and how something as simple as anger and maybe petty jealousy turned into something as serious as murder. And then we see how something as simple as I needed to control what I was looking at escalated to adultery and murder and everything else that went along with that. When we talk about self-control, we might think it's a small thing. We might think, well, I need to work on that. But it's not a small thing. It's that which is the beginning of the big things. We know that sin is sin, that all sin separates us from God. The first sin that David committed in this chain of sin would have separated him from God until he had repented of it, just as the big, what we would consider the big sins. And from a consequential standpoint, they were very big sins. But they would have separated from God just as well. But the point that I want to make is this. When it comes to self-control, it really is going to be the difference between not only a good life here on earth and a bad life here on earth, but it's also going to be the difference between being saved and being lost. We know that we deserve being lost. We know that all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. But we also know that because of Christ's sacrifice and God's grace, that we have a chance to come back. Mentioned before, it has to be on their terms. It has to be through repenting of our sins. If we've not had our sins washed away, that has to be done as well. But again, this idea of self-control may seem very small to us, but as we see how self-control continues to erode, we see that maybe it's one of the most important things that we can possess. In fact, it's a fruit of the Spirit, and it's that we want to close with in Galatians chapter 5 and verse 22. The fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. Against such things there is no law. Those who belong to Christ have crucified the sinful nature with its passions and desires. And then in Galatians chapter 5 and verse 25, Paul, through inspiration, sums it up this way: since we live by the Spirit, let us keep in step with the Spirit. Let us not become conceited, provoking, and envying each other. Keeping in step with the Spirit entails a lot of things, but one of those things is having the discipline to keep ourselves under control. Invitations open this evening. If anyone has a need to respond to the gospel's call, won't you do that while we stand and sing?